This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast.
We should be recording.
Yep.
All right, you're off to the wolves. I'll be right back.
Okay. What's up, everybody? How you doing?
What's up, Ken? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It is New Year. It's a time for new beginnings, and as such, we just posted on our blog feed, so that's pretty cool. Did anybody have anything in particular they wanted to talk about? I have something I can throw out there if you don't, but I figured we could open it up.
I'm along for the ride.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing right now. What do you got, Ken?
Okay. Well, so I was writing a case study earlier, and one of the things I brought up was the pediatric assessment triangle, which is usually something that gets pitched for kind of like younger children that are maybe nonverbal or, you know, not cooperative or, you know, inconsolable, stuff like that. But I really like the pediatric assessment triangle. I think it's a great tool to use as your across the room assessment for any patient. And I'm really a firm believer that 90% of our patients are across the room assessment can tell us if they're sick or not sick. There's always that 10% that kind of sneak by you. But I just think it's a cool tool, you know. When you think about it, you've got your three corners of it: the appearance, the work of breathing, and the circulation. Appearance, we think about things like tone, interactiveness, gaze, cry, consolability. Work of breathing, breath sounds, positioning, retractions, nasal flaring. And circulation, pallor, modeling, cyanosis, stuff like that. And this is all straight out of PALS, right? Like, and other classes use it too. But, you know, I just think when you walk into a room and you have a patient, whether they're 3, 30, or 300, if you look at them and you can assess these three basic steps, half the time you're already able to put them in the basket of sick or not sick. What do you guys think?
Part of that general assessment of obvious life threats.
Yeah.
100%. Like, this is, yeah, when I teach assessment, one of the first parts is your doorway assessment. There's a lot that goes into like your doorway assessment, and before we even like hands-on patient really, or vitals, auscultations, outpatient, all that stuff. There's a lot you can do from the doorway or like just by looking at your patient, and this highlights that perfectly. And there's a lot of people that have talked about how the paramedic assessment trial, it has them, but it works for everybody. Doing that doorway assessment and figuring it out, looking at the patient, do I have a baseline? Do I need to step up my questions? Do I need to hone in on certain things that I'm seeing already? And then going from there and just using this as kind of like your first step into your HPI, you know, figuring out like, is there a certain pathway I need to follow first to address these things? You know, say that doorway assessment, you have a patient that's tachypneic in the 40s and you hear rail. Okay, I already know I have a moderate to severe life threat. I need to start thinking about how I'm going to address. So what I need to do is set myself up for success for addressing this now and not in the unit, on the way, anything like that. And, you know, I like to incorporate something that I heard when I posted a case long ago in a Discord chat. And I use this to make my first assessment of my LLS score, my look like shit score. Either you look like shit or you don't look like shit. And then we're going to go from there. You know, and granted, this is not a be all end all. You start off and you look and you're like, man, this patient looks sick. And you get there and you start assessing and you're like, oh, not sick. or maybe not as serious as I thought it was, and the complete and utter opposite. You've got the patient that is compensating very well, or just is hiding these latent problems that are not on the surface, and then you start doing your assessment and you find out, oh, they're hypotensive, oh, they're tachycardic, oh, they're bradycardic, all these things, and then go from there.
Okay. Yeah, so if you could pick one finding, physical exam finding, from your doorway assessment for your LLS score, that would make you think, okay, this person is probably going to be really sick, what would it be for you guys? And I'll give you mine after the two of you answer.
I'm going to pick circulation to skin. Being someone that is pale, cool, you can't get the cool. Pale and diaphoretic. Already you're like, okay, something's up. Now let me find out what that is, and let me get proven wrong or proven right in this process. Skin is a great indicator of early issues with perfusion. I think of a patient that I ended up pacing that, some people would say maybe it was borderline pace or pharmacological, but their skin was my tip off that something was wrong. I could tell that they were pale, that they were not quite right. And then when I touched it, I always like to say it was doughy. And I knew perfusion was out of whack. She ended up being a third degree block, paced her, things got better, ended up having a massive right wall MI.
What about you, Cody?
I'm a work of breathing guy. That's generally the first thing a patient is going to use to compensate. And maybe that's back from like doing sepsis protocol research days. That work of breathing is compensatory. I'm trying to blow something off, or the body knows that it's in shock and it needs more oxygen, so it's trying to bring more in. I think there's plus and minuses to kind of having one as a go-to, but if somebody's breathing, obviously, like you can see their effort from across the room, it's one of those things where I'm like, I need to get on this quicker than usual. But I definitely agree with Josh that if you neglect a skin and circulatory assessment and only rely on one of the other two, well, then your assessment kind of falls apart, right?
Yeah, and maybe we should kind of preface this discussion with the fact that a complete assessment is necessary to build a complete picture, right? Like, we're not going to just look at one part or the other of this. We're not going to just look at circulation. We're not going to just look at work of breathing. We all have our own things we kind of key in on. And for me, one of those things is kind of what Josh already mentioned with the circulation of the skin. For me, diaphoresis is one of those findings that whenever I have someone who's truly diaphoretic, I'm like, okay, you're really sick, right? Like, this person is definitely not well. You shouldn't be sweating buckets for no reason. But let's talk about appearance anyway, since you guys did such a good job with circulation and work of breathing. I think when you look at somebody's overall appearance and how they're holding themselves, if they have poor muscle tone, they're not interacting with their environment, stuff like that, that's a huge red flag as well. And then when you get into kids, inconsolable kids, that's always a huge red flag. If they won't feed, if mom or dad holding them isn't helping, or, whatever the case is, those are all big things. So I really like this, LLS score, Josh. What other kinds of physical findings kind of jump into the LLS score for you?
Well, real quick, talking about, the diaphoresis in the doorway. So I had gotten tricked actually last shift on that one. We went to an apartment for trouble breathing, culturally, it was a hot apartment, as in this culture typically has a hot home. So we're like, okay, it's warm in here. Get in there, and the patient is pacing around the room trying to get things together. but is very visibly diaphoretic. You know, you can see the very, very much sheen on his forehead. He's got, you know, beads of sweat coming down, and already my mind's like, okay, this is something's up. He's got trouble breathing. Family said it's happened suddenly. And then he starts telling me, oh, he's been sick for a little while. I'm like, okay, so this is like narrowing things down. We do everything inside, 12 lead, clear, vitals, clear, history. Okay, seems like maybe this is, you know, just, you know, something, an illness of some sort. Get him out in the unit. As soon as we're outside, diaphoresis stops. As soon as we're in the unit, the whole time, the rest of the call, he never sweated again. And I'm like, oh, it was his hot apartment, most likely. You know, yes, could there be other things going on? But, you know, it, for the most part, it was like one of those, like, you know, fakeouts. Almost. So that's where the rest of your assessment comes into play. We can't just, you know, attribute all of our things, all of our worth to the assessment triangle or these very basic doorway assessments. We have to take everything into consideration, which parlays into what you just asked, Ken. Things. Let me think on it. Cody, you got a good answer for mine? I just gave a different answer.
No, not that I can. I could come up with it off the top of my head, which is great for conversation, right?
Yeah. That's fine. So let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about some of the really concerning life threats that kind of sneak up on us. You know, we don't have to do physiologic deep dives into all of them, but just, you know, things that maybe are not terribly obvious or evident from the get-go, you know, like that thoracic aneurysm that we like to text each other about all the time and, you know, stuff like that.
It comes down to basic assessment skills, right? Blood, you know, if you don't want to get caught by a thoracic aneurysm and you've got a chest pain patient, take blood pressures in both arms. Do one a manual and one a non-invasive. You know, do a full, complete assessments on folks. And you should mitigate something sneaking up on you. Unless it's you've gotten to your patient to in a compensatory phase of their illness, and oh, you look okay right now, I think it's safe enough to RSI this patient, and then you uncover all this physiologic derangement when you push your induction agent or whatever.
How often? So I don't come from an RSI jurisdiction. I don't know a whole lot about RSI. How often does it happen where you go to induce somebody and suddenly things get worse?
Peri and post intubation hypotension carries with it. I'll have to get my notebook right quick because I don't want to give you the wrong number. But the range is somewhere between. So there was the prevent trial, which looked at a bundle. That was the Jabber paper. Let me get through this. Wardy was a 5 to 30% occurrence of hypotension. 3% of those died within 30 minutes of intubation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Of those, 84% mortality with ROSC. So even though we got them back, 84% of them still bought it. And the biggest predictor of that in that paper was a shock index greater than 1. Or the intubation happened within an hour of shift change, or the use of sucks for whatever reason. It was the only paper I found that had that association. Now, interestingly, the NEAR paper, 0.5 to 4.2% occurrence, 32% mortality. Yikes, right?
Yeah.
Associated with SpO2 less than 91 and a systolic less than 100. I encourage all you guys to read these papers, and maybe we can link it for them on the Instagram page. DeZhong paper was 2.7% occurrence, 73.5% mortality. And they went ahead and debunked the sucks part. They said sucks was not associated with peri or post-intubation hypotension.
Cody, I have to ask, what were the limitations for each of the papers?
Some of the time to a pretty significant amount of the time. I think it comes down to patient selection. And this newer mentality that I'm developing, you know, we say resuscitate before intubate. And it kind of leaves this wiggle room to, I don't have time. But I think we should instead take an approach, resuscitate no matter what, then intubate. So maybe we could popularize this and get it going. Make t-shirts, resuscitate, then intubate. We'll keep up with the pasta water patches.
Yeah.
Cody, for the papers you were talking about, what were the, I think we're talking over each other. My bad. Go ahead, Josh.
The whole, like, critically unstable patient, like, and this actually came up at lineup today, and that we need to be properly assessing our patients ahead of time, regardless of what we see from the doorway, and then deciding from there what to do to stabilize the patient before movement, or like super advanced treatments, which in my service, we don't have RSI, so we don't have this higher level intervention that does carry risk that, you know, Cody just very eloquently and put out, you know, what it is. And we know about this. This is becoming a more commonly preached and commonly known thing that peri-arrest intubation is, you know, a known thing, and that we need to be doing things to counter it. Just like peri-arrest movement. You know, moving patients that shouldn't be moved before we stabilize them, and then they are coding before we have a good picture of what's going on. And even
the new paper looked into those patients where we're like, oh, we got to go right now. They're that sick. And the outcomes were abysmal with that as well. So it behooves us to take our time and resuscitate patients. So kind of to a case review type thing that we've got going here. I recently went to fly a patient who was in septic shock, hypoxic as all get out, had 2 liters of fluid before we got there, and 120 gauge IV. Thank you. and it was like, man, she's super hypoxic. We're going to have to do something about this at some point. But do we do it here? And do we do it now? Or can we be the resuscitation phase? That way, when we deliver this patient who's going to be a difficult intubation, when we deliver this patient, they have something to work with. Like we delivered the patient. She was not hypotensive. She was hemodynamically stable, but still sat in 80s, low 90s, bouncing off the 70s. And we were like, man, what do you do with this? We kind of went back and forth a little bit about our decision making, and, you know, decided that, you know, maybe it was the right thing to do to take our time and use our 15, 16 minute flight as the resuscitation phase, have the patient with some pressors on board. We've done something for pre-oxygenation. We ended up bagging her a little bit to try to get that functional reserve capacity up. But we had so many disconnects and room air entrainment that it was probably the limited of efficacy. But however, we knew that patient wasn't going to be hypotensive when we delivered them. And so at least that ICU had that to go with. And the levo was already up. It's one less thing they had to do. And the patient was hemodynamically stable and maybe, you know, could have made it through a trial of BiPAP, which is what they were set up for when we left. So, you know, maybe not every intubation has to be done by us. Maybe, you know, if they're super complicated, hemodynamically unstable and completely gorked, you know, maybe the smart thing to do is to sink a supraglottic, pre-oxygenate that patient, stabilize those hemodynamics, get them to the ER so that ED physician doesn't have to spend the next hour stabilizing the patient just so they can intubate them.
So it's a question of priorities, right? And I think it really lends to a larger discussion about what the patient needs, when they need it, and what the ED capabilities or the receiving facility capabilities are, and what's going to be beneficial to be done in the field versus, you know, done in the ED. Because I've always been of the mindset that if we can do it, we should, if it's smart, right? So there comes a point where we need to acknowledge that we may be able to do things that might not be of the most benefit to the patient right now, but there may be something else we can do that is more beneficial. And it may not be as flashy and sexy to hang Levofed than as it is to RSI somebody. But the reality is it might be in the best interest of everybody if we just maintain that nice hemodynamic stability and let them trial, like you said, BiPAP in the ICU. You know, maybe that's what the patient needs.
Yeah.
Bob Mabry talked about this, or Colonel Mabry talked about this in a paper where he outlined kind of these strategic pillars for improving combat casualty care. And, you know, in the military, there was a little bit of this mentality of kind of what you were talking about, kind of get them, just get them there. You know, do something and get them there. But what he points out is there's an operational tax for that. And now this receiving facility has to go back and do things that were absolutely inside of your scope to resuscitate their patient, to get them ready for the emergency department phase of care. Mm-hmm. And it started kind of describing this concept of EMS as a link in a chain of emergency medicine.
You know, can you talk about like doing what's right for the patient at the right time? And sometimes some things are not as sexy as others. So, you know, RSI, you know, that's something that's, you know, thought as quote unquote sexy within paramedicine, because not everyone can do it. Not every agency does it. Not every agency has the capabilities of doing it. But we never think about other things that, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, fall into the quote unquote sexy category, but is critical thinking and clinical like decision making on scene not sexy? So let's think about this. You have that patient that you show up and they are let's say they're a hypotensive CHF. Yes, it happens. It's scary. It's not fun. But can we CPAP someone that has a systolic that's 90 positive pressure ventilation, that's going to enter the chest, it's going to drop that pressure, and now you have a cardiac arrest. You don't have a CHF patient anymore, you have a cardiac arrest, and that's good with another algorithm. Mike talked about this the other day with one of Cody's coworkers that when he first started doing RSIs, he thought the induction agent and the paralytic was what caused intubation arrest. Then he realized is our introduction of positive pressure ventilation following those induction agents. And he talks about how with event, SIMV, that initial breath is much larger than all the rest because it has to calibrate the vent to what needs to be done. And that's dropping that pressure. So, let's go back to our patient that's a CPAP, that's a CHFer, and they're hypotensive. We can't CPAP them. So what do we have to do? We got to think about how we can get that pressure up so we can do that. You know, we have things like Epi. Other agencies have Levo. Later this year, Maryland will have Levo. You know, getting these pressors on board to bring that pressure up so that we can deliver the care that is actually going to help the patient the most in the long. And it's this bundle, but that's going to do that. And it's a little bit different than what we're used to. You know, we're used to CPAP, nitro, with, you know, ACE or drip or sublingual, whatever your agency is using, and then that's it. But when we get encountered with the different patient, now comes the critical thinking, the clinical, the really truly clinical decision making that is going to benefit this patient. And I think that's why I've always said I love medical calls over trauma. I've had a lot of trauma lately, and they've been some good calls. So I always love me a good medical call because it's going to make you think and figure out where do I need to go within what is in my mind, what is in my protocols, and what is going to benefit the patient the most. So back to Ken saying doing the right thing at the right time for the patient. That's really where that is. And I also want to say something else. You know, Cody brought up He's talking about interfacility transfers. You know, Cody, you know, that's his bread and butter. That's the world he lives in. You know, he does critical care. And even in those situations, they're coming to super sick patients that the sending facility is trying to get away from them as fast as possible because they don't have the capabilities to properly treat these patients. So it's just like us showing up where the family's freaking out, like, get my grandma, get my grandpa out of the house to the hospital because the hospital can do all this care. It's only the hospital, not the paramedics. And so critical care shows up, and now it's not like, oh, shit, we got to bundle this patient up, throw him in the helicopter, and we're going to fly as fast as we can, do everything in the helicopter, and hope we get to the hospital in time. No, it's going to be a possibly long assessment, resuscitation, stabilization, and then package. And we do the same thing in the field in just a little bit different environment and way. It's the same. We may have different drugs, we may have different interventions, but it is the same, just in a different environment.
Yeah, I think I've said this before, that critical care is not a location. It is a mindset.
I like that. And I also like Josh. Sorry, go ahead, Josh. Oh, sorry, I thought you were going to say something. I also like that you brought up the whole idea of critical thinking and reasoning skills and just our ability to use those and develop those skills. I think that's one of the hardest things to teach. I don't really know that they can be taught in a classroom. For me, I mean, you can do scenarios, you can do, you know, exercises about stuff like that. But for me, the bulk of the critical thinking abilities are really taught in the field with the clinical externships and stuff like that, where you see real patients and you have to connect what's in a textbook to what you actually see, you know, in an actual patient presentation. You know what I mean? So I've always struggled with, you know, how do you teach critical thinking in a classroom? What do you think, Cody?
Yes, because critical thinking, and especially in our world, it is very experiential. Part of your ability to develop a good, healthy list of differentials is based on not heuristics, and maybe that is the right word, but it's, have I seen this before? What happened last time? What did I do for it? And then what was the outcome? And oftentimes, we don't really know what happened after we dropped them off, unless you're doing good follow-ups. The framework can be presented in a classroom, but as you know, working at being with an educational institution, you know how hard or how much of a deviation that is from curriculum, almost to the degree that it puts them at a disadvantage when they get to like that national registry. They'll overthink those questions, and right. We overthink on scene and at the bedside all the time.
Sure.
So maybe it's not just uniquely a testing problem.
Yeah, well, it's hard, you know, because like 80% of the time it is what it looks like it is. You know, they say when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras, right? But sometimes it is a zebra. And we get so trained to have like this Dr. House mentality where everything we're looking at is some convoluted, strange thing that you might see once in a career, you know, when most of the time your patient is having abdominal pain and vomiting because, you know, they're in DK and their sugar is, you know, 600. But once in a while, it's what's that?
Or they just have a stomach bug.
Or they have a stomach bug, right. But once in a while, it is that funky thing that pops up. And I think the real key is to be able to differentiate between what we can assess in the field effectively and what maybe requires something more like imaging or you know, and making sure we get them to a hospital that is able to provide those capabilities.
To the degree, it comes down to the experience level of the preceptors. If the preceptor isn't doing a great job of unpacking the classroom in the back of the ambulance, then that new medic and even the preceptor as well, they're at a little bit of a disadvantage for that critical thinking. I was talking to a colleague on the gram within the last couple of days, and so there's an acronym that I use for that, because I think there is a place for the zebra in your assessment, but it's like number three on the list. So it's SPIT. So severe, as severe. What's going to kill this individual right now related to the presentation or chief complaint? So you work through those. And if you find something, it's probably safe to just live right there until that patient looks a little more stable. And then you get to the P, which is probable. This is probably XYZ. And then you develop a treatment plan that, or let me rephrase, you can refine that treatment plan and keep things moving forward. And then you get to I. And I think it's good to humor your imagination, like on occasion, as appropriate. And just think about something that's interesting. So that's what the I is. So this is where you humor your imagination and you can chase down and lasso that zebra if you want to. And then the T is treatment plan that addresses probably where you landed.
I like that a lot. Yeah. I like that a whole lot. You always have the most interesting acronyms and stuff like that.
I steal them from people and I can't remember where I stole them from. That's the awful reality I live in. So I can't give credit. I wish I make those up.
So Cody, you highlighted something I teach all my students actually, is, and I got it from my dad. My dad taught me, because he taught in his paramedic assessment class that the most important thing, first and foremost, is what is going to kill your patient in front of you. Okay, so based off of, just like you said, your HPI. This isn't like, oh, I go for the headache, and, well, they could have necrotizing fasciitis in their toe, and that's going to kill them. So I think I need to address that. No, not that. It's, okay, they've got a headache. Could it be an aneurysm? Could it be a hypertensive crisis? Could it be this, that, the other thing? And I'm gonna have to mute here for a second. But so like it's, and I always then correlate it, and I talk about the MI that you pace. You know, we've talked about that here and how that is a controversial topic with some people. What is going to kill your patient in front of you? Well, the MI could, but you know what's going to kill them a lot quicker? Bradycardia and hypoperfusion. So let's correct that. Exactly. You know, and reduce cardiac output, that's going to reduce cardiac output to the coronary veins and arteries, and it's just, it's a cascading effect. So pace them. Fix what's going to kill them. It's a life threat. And then let's worry about the STEMI. And honestly, the STEMI, there's not a whole lot of things we can do. Aspirin does great things. Do it. STEMI alerts. Do it. But get them to the hospital. And if we can provide a live, viable patient, they can go to the cath lab.
I always like to ask people when they say stuff like, don't pace the MI, like, what's your plan? Like, what are you going to do to make this situation better? And if the answer is nothing, then it's like, maybe we should reevaluate that too, you know?
Fair questions. Fair.
So,
but
you have to. Sorry, go ahead, Josh.
No, you're good. I don't think we're finished with the topic. I have another topic, so let's finish this one, and I'll bring up something else that came up.
I was going to say, when we're talking about should I do X or should I do Y, the question that should follow that immediately, what's the risk of not doing X and not doing Y? And what's the benefit of not doing X or not doing Y? And if you're, my protocol says, pops up in that discussion somewhere, pass that decision to somebody else, for the love of Pete, if somebody else is available.
Yep. I'm very much a cost benefit analysis person, and that applies to patients as well. If I don't pace you and you could die from that, and the alternative is you could die if I do pace you, is it better to treat what I know will kill you versus what might kill you if I do it? You know, I mean, you have to almost look at it from a litigation standpoint. If I do nothing and that person dies, what are they going to say in court? What's my QA officer going to say? What's my medical director going to say? If I treat the patient who was hemodynamically unstable and might die either way, at least I did something to try to improve the situation. And you have to be smart about it. You shouldn't just do things just to do things, right? But if the cost-benefit analysis says, hey, there's a decent chance a person could get better if you do this, and there's a decent chance they could die if you don't do anything. Just my two cents.
It's also, it comes into play when you're picking between two things that are going to achieve the same goal, but maybe one's going to achieve it a little bit better. You know, the dilemma right now of the sepsis protocol in Maryland. Do you just go ahead and say, you know, I'm going to go by the protocol and give 2 liters of fluid wide open and then see what happens? Or do you do a critical assessment of the patient and figure out, oh, they are actually on the downhill side of this map, and I need to give something to get that up, and then I can give fluids? Are both going to achieve the same goal? Roughly, possibly, you know, it depends. Are both suitable treatments and adjuncts to making this happen? Yes, but one's better than the other in this case. It's going to achieve a better outcome. And we need to be thinking about looking at our patient as a whole, looking at all those vitals. You know, Cody, you know, very easily, but very well illustrated how the map is a very fine line. You know, that line in the protocol says a map is 65. That's great. Well, guess what? A map of 60 is actually really bad. And if they keep on slipping back down that slope, it's that much harder to get a hold of them and bring it back. It's kind of, you know, for anyone that wants to think about it, it's kind of like the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. Once you slip off that cliff, it's a fight to get back up. You know, especially if you have other factors that are making upward, left, down, and right shifts. You know, figure out what is going to work best for your patient in the time, and pick the, you know, the better of the two, the three, whatever, how many options you have. You know, sometimes there is a objectively better treatment. Right now, there is a discussion being had in certain agencies around the nation of what's a better pressor in ROSC, Epi or Levo. There are some agencies that have changed what they're doing. There is data that says, yeah, Levo could be good, but it's small patient sets. So once again, two tools that'll do the same thing, but what is better? And that's in that specific case, that is something that we are actively, as a profession, figuring out. Not even so much as EMS. The hospitals are trying to figure this out too. Like, what is the better pressor of the two for that case? But yeah, it's a lot of this. I'd say everything we've been talking about is about critical assessment, critical thinking, and making the actual positive outcome clinical decisions. Like, don't cookie cutter it. Don't, you know, protocol book it. You got to figure out what is going to work best for your patient with what you're given and go from there. Not just, well, that's not going to work. So I just got to, I guess, treat with what, high octane diesel, you know? You know, good old saying there.
You have to be honest and well attended with what you're doing. You know, if you're getting close to the lines, you know, in the protocols of, you know, this drug, the science says this, but my protocol says this, be honest about what you're doing and be well intended with what you're doing. Because the only two things that either a QA officer, a medical director, or a jury and judge are going to say about what you did is going to be one of two things. It's going to be you were careless, so you knew what the right thing to do was, and either or you didn't know what the right thing to do was, and therefore you shouldn't have been in that situation in the first place, or you knew what you were supposed to do and you didn't do it, or number two is negligence. And that one is, you know, as we've learned, it's inexcusable.
Yeah, that is very much on display right now in EMS. Front page, big black headlines on the top of the paper, that negligence is the wrong answer. Not doing your job properly is the wrong answer all the time.
Yep.
And this will be used as a basically a reference to future cases. Without saying which case.
Precedent. Yes. Yeah. No, I think those are all very valid points. And I think it's important to always have that view of litigation as a possible outcome. That's always something that has stuck with me throughout my practice as a paramedic. It shouldn't be the driving force for every decision, right? The driving force for every decision should be doing the right thing for the right patient at the right time. But we should be mindful of the fact that we live in a very litigious world, and that, you know, accidents and poor decisions can have consequences. It's very important that we are mindful of that, and that we treat that area of this work with great respect.
So actually, now that I think about it, the thing I wanted to bring up does all tie into this. So once again, going back to that critical thinking, clinical decision making process. So the day after Christmas, ran a motor vehicle accident that resulted in a severe TBI patient that had some tricky airway management. We bagged, we did two-hand method, we attempted intubation. I'll call myself out. I got clung up on the cords, wasn't able to pass the tube. We went back to bagging, two-hand technique, straps on the mask, full 9 yards. And things were going okay. And okay is probably overselling it a little bit. Things got a lot worse when we put a collar on. We went to put a collar on, and it pushed her jaw up, and it occluded her airway. So now when we were bagging, all we were doing was inflating her cheek. And so it's one of those things where, you know, like, hey, we got a patient that was in a serious accident. You know, the telemetry data, you know, pull out some scientific words, telemetry data are saying this impact is going to cause major damage to the human body. And in all of our minds, this patient is a backboard C-collar patient. But sometimes those things just are not conducive to good patient care. And that's where we have to make the decision, like, hey, I understand what is kind of expected in this patient, but what is expected is not going to benefit the patient. So you need to take measures to still provide some of the same level of care, in this case, stability. We opted to head block and C-collar. You know, it's going to provide some amount of inline stabilization to the neck. And if you also then go back and look at, you know, the data with C-collars and backboards, we're finding more and more that even C-collars may be not the greatest idea. And that, you know, where they say, well, the C-collar, you know, is to help prevent movement after the injury and us inducing injuries. Well, a lot of the telemetric data is saying that the amount of force needed to cause the injury is something that we as human beings and paramedics cannot inflict, you know. And so it's just things to think about. That doesn't just apply to C-collars and advanced airway management. But we eventually dropped a king on this patient, and we were able to oxygenate. Unfortunately, had a not a good outcome for the patient, but it was a call that violated a lot of, like, critical thinking and decision making in the heat of the moment. So, just overall, once again, assess the interventions you're doing and see if they are working correctly and benefiting you and the patient.
Well, and that goes back to what we were just talking about, reassess. You have to reassess. You can't just check your patient out once and assume they're good. After every intervention, after every time period that is deemed appropriate by your protocols or training, after every change in the patient's complaint, any change in their pain, anything, they need to have a full reassessment done. And that does include putting your hands on the patient and doing a physical exam as appropriate. I'm not saying you need to do a full body sweep every time you reassess, but maybe you do need to listen to lung sounds again. Maybe you do need to check their skin condition again. Maybe you do need to check that bandage and see how the bleeding's doing, stuff like that. It's EMS 101. Just put your eyes on that end title, just put your eyes on that SpO2, that ECG, print out another 12 lead, whatever you have to do. Reassess, do it, check that blood sugar if you haven't done it already, or maybe even if you already did.
Ken, you highlight the reassessment. And on this patient that I just talked about, initially, there was an auscultation of the chest that someone was saying she is absent on the right side. Like, okay, cool, maybe, the impact, how she was in the vehicle, hey, it's not out of the realm of possibility that she had a blunt force trauma in the chest or, a fractured rib that caused puncture to the pleural space, and hold on yards. We know where this goes. But we reassessed because it just didn't fit. There was no injury to the chest that fit. Okay, let's reassess. Three different providers listened to the lung sounds. And in the end, we determined, no, good left, good right, clear and equal. We're bagging. Everything's good. We are ruling out attention pneumo. But if you go off your initial assessment, or another provider's assessment, and base all of your care off of that, it can lead you down a bad path. And in this case, it could have led us down a path of needling when needling wasn't required. And then throughout the rest of the transport, constant reassessment. Is this working? Is that working? What's better? What's less? We had a hypertensive blood pressure, resulted in us giving DXA. The next one was up, so that held off on FA. Stuff like that, not just taking the initial assessment, but taking everything into consideration. I can't help but sit here and think we are having an episode about the basics of the job: assessment, reassessment, and treatment in between, and then reassessment again. And it is so vitally important to talk about right now.
It is, and I really like what you brought up, Josh. If there's any question about your assessment finding, and maybe even if there's not, have that second EMT or paramedic put hands on your patient and double check, especially if it's a critical thing that you found or didn't find. Have someone else double check. And no disrespect to anybody, but never take somebody else's assessment as gospel. Put your hands on that patient and assess them yourself. Because what it comes down to, if you are the primary care provider for this person during the transport or at the scene, you're the one who's making the decisions. You're the one who's providing the actions, the medications, the procedures. And those decisions need to be made based on your decision, based on your finding.
Yeah, Cody. You live in a world of high-level assessments prior to your arrival. But yet, what do you do every time you transport a patient?
Transport verify.
Like, you're...
The buckets come off, our monitor goes on, and we do our thing. And it's not to discount or discredit what was done before we got there, but I'm going to do my thing. Because I trust me.
Yeah. You're going to go through the vent settings, the pump settings, Yeah, if they've got a chest tube, you're going to reassess the chest tube. You're going to reassess everything that's been done to this patient and everything that you're going to transfer as well to make sure, hey, you know, hey, these are the vent settings you have. But something doesn't seem right. Like, this patient isn't responding appropriately to these vent settings. So let's figure this out and not just copy and paste. Not take your sending facility's word for it. Because that's how patients die.
So that was a...
in our care.
That was a big thing during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Where you walk in, and I called some friends of mine in the industry, and I was like, look, am I just being a jerk and walking in and going, those vent settings are not working, and I'm going to do my own thing. And so you unpack the story with them a little bit, and you're like, well, I really can't imagine why this patient who has ARDS should be receiving 18 liters of minute ventilation. My eyebrows did the same thing. That was so common to walk in and see overventilation.
Insert
ARDS. And that's where...
insert ARDSnet protocol.
So interesting you say that. There's something like... it was an ED study. It was something like 20 or 22% of ED physicians don't adhere to those guidelines. And we don't exactly know why. But in ICU, that should be a little bit of a different story. And that's not what we saw. But that's where I got comfortable looking at what was going on with the vent and what was going on with the patient. And you know, doing what I... One was supported by what my medical director expected me to do. And two, I got embarrassed one time, horribly embarrassed in the CCRU at Shock Trauma. And my justification for those vent settings were, that's what they were on. And I got that look from them like, I'll never take you seriously again for the rest of your life. You're dead to us. And I made a deal with myself at that point that I will never again just do it because, well, it seemed to be working at the other facility. That's not what's expected of us when we show up. And that's we as in all of us. 911, critical care transport, HEMS. You're in the back of a friggin' Toyota Hilux and Honduras. The expectation is that you know what you're doing and you do the right thing. Think before you act. Those are the right things to do.
Yeah. And it's true as much in inner facility as it is in pre-hospital, right? Think before you act. I always like that saying, trust, but verify, you know, like these are things we should be practicing and preaching. It's critical that when we assess a patient, we do it with an open mind, despite what we may have been told already, right? We want to make sure that we take in all the possibilities from that spit mnemonic that you brought up. It's really crucial stuff. Yeah.
That's been a good talk.
It has.
Real good talk. All started
that's
by
been a good talk.
Pediatric assessment triangle.
And who knew it would bring us here?
I mean, it does.
But I don't know. Do one of you guys want to close this out?
Hold on. I will say, like I said in the beginning, it all circles back. Like, we're circling back right now, you know, finishing, like, saying, it all start with pediatric assessment triangle. I said, that doesn't only apply to pediatric. Just, like, not all, you know, assess every patient. You can use that as a helpful way to remember things and use a way to figure out your doorway assessment, your look like shit scale, whatever you want. You know, there's tons of things out there. But ultimately, assess, treat, and reassess. I thought of one the other day, like off the OODA. It was, I think I said, orient, assess, decide, and reassess. So order. Essentially, ORDR, you know, because you have to kind of orient yourself to the patient, to the scene, to what's going on, You know, hectic scenes, quiet scenes, all scenes. You need to assess. So no, that was OADR. Sorry, OADR. Assess, decide, reassess. And then you're going to keep on doing that throughout the rest of your call. You might not have the orient so much for the ADR. Today's the day of acronyms. Or mnemonics.
I like
mnemonics.
It.
It's for medical Thursdays.
We're creating content for ourselves. Okay.
All right, Cody, anything left?
No, not just like okay. I said. That's think okay. Before you act, do the right thing. You should be okay.
I hope Moose had a great time listening to us. It's okay to laugh.
All right. Who? Josh, Cody, you want to close this out?
I'll close this out. So once again, everyone, thank you for listening to this. I'm guessing it was a shock index in the end for us all. Welcome to the new year. Hope you had good holidays, however you decided to spend it. Hope you're well. Hope you're safe. Hope your family is well and safe as well. But thank you for listening. Wherever you are, good evening, good morning, good night, good afternoon, and be safe. See you next time.
That's right. Now the question is